Jewish women, oral history to Selma Weiss and Howard Braun are interviewing Robert Frommerman. The date is June 20th, 1997.
At his house in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh.
Are you starting this?
I started it. And
okay, it's wiping over. I'm telling my
No.
Well, at Howard's request, he asked me to talk a little bit about this house. We're sitting in a solarium looking out, or at least I'm looking out, on part of the garden at the side of the house. This house is almost 100 years old. It was part of a Mellon estate, which was subdivided many years ago. It was designed and built by Benno Jansen, who in his day built most of the good things in Pittsburgh. He designed and built Coffman's Department Store, the Pittsburgh Athletic Association, and many other buildings and a number of homes. And you can see architectural similarities in curvature of windows and a number of features. When we moved into this house about 30 years ago, we had been looking for some time, and when we found it, I was just delighted with the layout because it was so much nicer than anything we had seen anywhere in the Pittsburgh area. And we've been so happy here that we've decided to stay here, and so a year or two ago we put on an addition to the house. We put on a large breakfast room and a utility room in the back of the house. And our big problem was making the architecture agree with the Benno Jansen home without downgrading it. And that turned out to be more of a job than I thought about at first, but we're pleased with how it worked out.
Bob, you have an exceptional collection of art prints in various rooms, and I think they're noteworthy enough to ask you to mention them.
Well, they go back quite a ways. I first began collecting etchings when they were the only fine art that I could afford. And as a matter of fact, they still make up the core of our collection. And at that time, I was getting them for a couple dollars a piece. And there was a wonderful little shop in Greenwich Village. And there was a crotchety old man who had this shop. And every time I went to New York, which was quite frequent, I found my way down to Greenwich Village and I bought a pile of etchings. And in fact, I've given away more than I have. My daughter Julie has a number of them. Bruce has a number of them. And Marcia's sister, various friends. But at any rate, I always bought what I liked. And so I turned down things like Goya's and Caprices, because I didn't like them, and I just bought the kinds of things that I enjoyed. And they led us into some pretty fair stuff. We have a number of artist proofs by Sir William Russell Flint, who is an eminent British watercolorist. He was a Scotsman. He started out as a medical illustrator, which requires very meticulous work. And he became famous for his imaginative landscapes and particularly for his women. And many beautiful women of his day posed for him. One of his favorite models, for instance, was Moira Shearer, the famous ballet star. We have some artwork done by our friend Angela Connor, who is a British artist, whose work has been opened by the Queen in London. Much of her work also is in Chatsworth, the estate of the Duke of Devonshire, who has a collection of art in England, second only to the Queen's. So we're in good company, and Angela was a friend of ours and stayed here when she was doing the sculpture in Pines Garden. Acquainted, and we've gone back and forth to her home and she to ours. In fact, both of our children spent part of their honeymoons in her wonderful estate in in England on the edge of Wales. And she has there a very large estate, she and her husband. And they breed and raise Morgan horses, and they are the Morgan Horse Society of England. And they live there. They have their main home is in London, of course, but in their country estate, their house goes back to the 12th century. Or maybe it's the 13th century. Anyway, it's a delightful place to be. It's perhaps the best example I can think of bucolic England. I guess that's about enough for hard-working artists. Now, where I left off was when my work at Blahnox was winding down, and in fact the contracts at Blahnox were winding down. And I decided it was probably time to look around, although
what
I
what year was that?
Around 1953. Yeah, I guess it was around 1953. And I hadn't done anything in particular about it. And one night I was at a meeting for the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, and I ran into an old business friend, or perhaps a rather new business friend, Dr. Roger Shields. And Roger was the manager of research and development at Elliott Company that I had come from back when. And Roger approached me and asked me to rejoin Elliott Company and be manager of process engineering in the development section. So, after some thought, I did. I accepted the offer. And when I went in to tell my boss at Chem Plants, he told me that in spite of the fact that Chem Plants was winding down and was going to have a number of layoffs, that my position there was secure and in fact would probably grow. He did try to induce me to stay, but I was impatient and I decided that I didn't want to wait out this turnaround, which would take a few years. So I left. You might think when you go back to a company that you had worked for only 3 years before, you might know what you were getting into. Well, that's a fallacy. I did move into that job and into that company, of course, in a much different position than what I had left. And I had some fellows working for me now, some engineers working for me. And I was also in charge of some of the test work, development test work. And somehow the whole atmosphere there just wasn't that happy. And in addition, I was fresh from some tragedies in my personal life that left me in not the best of moods. So, although I did my work and did some rather interesting things there, it was not a place where I was especially happy. One of the things that I did successfully was to develop a 6-stage steam jet ejector. And at the time this project came up, one of our largest clients, Union Carbide, came to us at Elliott Company and said that their very high vacuum pumps, which were oil diffusion pumps, were always requiring maintenance because the oil got dirty and they were on metallurgical applications. And they said that if we would develop an ejector that could handle that high vacuum, they would buy a large number of them. So we decided we would try to develop it. And to make a long story short, we did successfully get the development to a point where we actually made it work and made the configuration work, and we actually got down to the level we wanted to get, although the characteristic of the machine is not good and required further work. And at this point, I asked the Vice President of Engineering to let me go out on the road and find out what kind of market we really have for this, because at that time Union Carbide said, well, we'll change our mind. And
didn't they pay for the development?
We didn't want them to pay for the development.
Yeah, I know what you were trying to do.
Right. Because we had a potential market.
Yeah, I know.
So I canvassed the country and did quite a bit of traveling, and I discovered that everybody was interested, but nobody was ready to buy. And I decided that to develop this with the not be a good deal, because what would happen is we would have a fully developed, ready-to-go machine, nobody would buy it, it would sit on the shelf, and the whole thing would die of boredom. Whereupon, whenever the applications did come about, the company would not be in that business. So I came back and I made that recommendation to the Vice President, that we shelve it for the time being. And so we did. Later, indeed, the market did develop. By that time, I was long gone. They did complete the development. Elliott was the only company in the world that sold 6-inch injectors. Another interesting thing that I was able to do while I was there, we had a contract to build a coaxial. This is not my great reason for everybody.
We might get somebody who's interested in mechanical engineering.
At any rate,
whatever.
I probably shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do it anyway.
No, actually, you do all right. You're fine. Yeah. Dropping individual names and product ideas of significance is a thing that doesn't happen often and really should be a part of our... It's only a very limited part of our record, and you're doing fine.
Anyway, we were developing a coaxial, axial flow compressor gas turbine, all on a single shaft. And this was a very large size machine. And in order to, and of course it's a very high speed machine, as a result of which it's subject to very high stresses. And particularly the hot end of it, that is the gas turbine, is subject to very high stresses, various kinds of stresses. One of the problems in the design is to be able to make a good stress analysis. But you cannot make a good stress analysis unless you have a heat flow pattern so that you understand what the temperature is at various parts in the rotor of the gas turbine. And we had not the foggiest notion of that.
Do the computers now, can you test the on the computers?
Well, there are a lot of things you can do now that you couldn't do then. So at any rate, I wrote something like 60 or 70 simultaneous equations to be solved and show the temperature flow in various parts of the rotor. And of course, trying to solve that number of simultaneous equations is a mammoth job. And I had two engineers working for me. I put them to work with mechanical calculators, and they cranked away for weeks. And I looked over their shoulder and watched what they were doing. And after a while, it became quite obvious to me that the smallest error on their part at any stage of the game would just derail the whole effort. And so at this point, I went searching for another way to do the job. IBM at that time was developing computers. And IBM had a place in Manhattan where they had many large-scale computers, and they were trying to write programs for them. And they were very anxious to market their services, which would give them a chance to underwrite their development programs. And they had a development program for simultaneous equations going on, but it was kind of stagnant. So we got together and we sold each other on the idea of IBM picking up these equations and completing their program and solving the equation for us. And indeed, it was a job for a large-scale computer.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the difference. There are two parts to a job like that. One, somebody writing the simultaneous equations. I would have known immediately he could never solve them, but he needed to do that. Then you need a computer to actually do all the solutions. And these days, they got all kinds of things for that.
Well, these days that job would have been easy.
Would have been easy. But he did the part that took the brains, really, the simultaneous equations.
So at any rate, we gave IBM the job, and I kept in very frequent contact with IBM by telephone, and they weren't making much headway. So I began to travel back and forth to New York to look over their shoulder to see what they were doing. And they kept making runs in which there were, the results were coming out obviously not quite right. And after a number of such back and forth missions to New York City, I realized that they just weren't going to get any further. And I began to realize something else, too. I probably might not have had enough significant figures in my equations to get the kind of accuracy that I needed to have. But at any rate, they gave enough of a pattern that I could hand-guess what the actual pattern was. And so I could replace the parts in error, because common sense showed me how to extrapolate from what they had in their pattern.
Get the name of that computer, that first big one of theirs. You remember?
ENIAC was the first one.
No, ENIAC was a different company.
That was
RCA.
I don't remember what it was. At any rate, the computer we were working on then would be dwarfed by a PC these days.
Oh, that's right. But it's nice to remember an old name.
But at any rate, that's how Elliot got into the business with computers. And I introduced them to that, and I began to find other applications for doing it. For instance, we could find the, I'm trying to remember what the term is, but we have a shaft with heavy loading, it's like a multi-stage turbine turning at high speeds. The shaft reaches a critical velocity where the bow in it turns as a bow. And that's the condition that you need to avoid. So you need to design the weight at the various points of the shaft so that that does not happen. This is a good job for a computer. Of course, we designed and built a lot of such machines, so that was another application. At any rate, the computer found a home in Elliott. So those were a couple of the interesting things I was able to do there.
Did you realize you were in competition with GE on that that rotating gas turbine?
At that time we were in competition with a lot of people. For instance, Elliott Company developed an oxygen plant of its own, which was really a first-rate oxygen plant. Incidentally, under the direction of Irv Roberts, who was the other Jew in the company. But Union Carbide had a war chest, which they were willing to spend a considerable amount of money not to have another competitor go into the business. So we never got a foot in the door. Another thing that Elliott Company was doing at that time was developing a coal-burning gas turbine, locomotive gas turbine. And in fact, there was a locomotive development committee that was funded for this purpose. And we did, in fact, build the turbines, although in the long run they were not fired by coal because it was not possible to solve some technical problems. That's right. So a lot of high-powered things were going on at Elliott at that stage of the game. It was an interesting company out of all proportion to the size of the company. And it had some very brilliant people, many of whom went on to much more eminent jobs.
Yeah, you were competing against the divisions of GE that had spent $20 million on each one of those projects you mentioned. I happen to know approximately those figures. You guys didn't. Totally different league.
That's right. We designed and built them just
the same. Yes, you designed and built them just the same.
In fact, we were probably one of the first people in the country in turbocharger business. But that's another ball game, and I had nothing to do with turbocharger. At any rate, my experience with gas turbines and my knowledge of gas turbines and their limitations and their problems were such that when the first turboprop airplanes came out, I waited for a year or so before I was willing to ride one. Because I wasn't sure that anybody would really do the maintenance on them that was necessary to be done. At any rate, from that job, around about that time that Marcia and I met.
What year?
And let's see. We were married in 1955. First met in December of 1954.
Good. Her last name
was Marcia Elovich, E-L-L-O-V-I-C-H. Now, Marcia came from Sharon, but she was sharing an apartment with a roommate, John Bertman. She was working and had been working at several jobs in Pittsburgh. At the time, as I recall, she was working for Dr. Flanagan, who was a psychologist and who prepared test questionnaires. And one of his specialties was questionnaires to assess whether an applicant for a job was a good fit for that, position. And one of Marcia's jobs was to prepare an applicant or to prepare a test for a draftsman. And I got quite a kick out of seeing how simplistic these questionnaires were, realizing what a kind of work that Flanagan was probably turning out. But at any rate, he was very successful at it. And Marcia was enjoying her job.
Where did she go to school?
Carnegie Mellon.
What was her major?
I'm trying to think whether psychology was her major. I can hardly remember my major.
It was Carnegie Tech.
It was Carnegie Tech in those days. And so by about March we were engaged. Marcia wanted to wait till May, at which time her brother Joe would be discharged from the Navy and would be able to attend the wedding. So for that reason, we were married on May 22nd, 1955.
How did you meet Marcia?
She was a blind date.
May what was that?
May 22nd.
1955. at the wedding, or who, anyone notable there, or by whom? By whom was it done?
Yeah, there were a lot of funny things about the wedding.
Was there a rabbi?
Yes, there was a rabbi. We were married in Sharon. And, of course, well, I remember the first time, maybe the first or second time, Marcia brought me home to Sharon. And we pulled up in my car in front of her parents' home, and we both stepped out. And another car going by slammed on the brakes with a squeal. And it was Gussie Applebaum, who was a friend of Marcia's mother, and a very nosy friend. And so she pulled over immediately and came running and flipped me over.
What kind of a background did Marcia come from? Was it a religious family, or what kind of background?
They were good attendees of a Reformed temple in Sharon. Marcia's father owned several drugstores in Sharon. One or two drugstores by the time I met Marcia. And Marcia's mother, Phil, by the way, had...
That's her father.
Yeah, Phil Ulrich, had emigrated to this country, had grown up in a very large family in Pittsburgh, had been in several businesses, one of which was selling, I believe, the earliest controllers, and he had an opportunity to buy the store in Sharon, and he did, and he moved there. And Miriam, Marcia's mother, worked in the drugstore for Phil. And that's how they got together. They were very sweet, very lovely people, very conscientious. During the war, they were highly conscious of what was going on in Germany. They were very plugged into it, and everybody who came to raise funds stayed at the Yelovich home in Sharon. And they were very large contributors, and also they underwrote many people coming, many refugees coming into this country. That kept them working very hard to make a living and stay ahead of all these contributions. Very sweet, very lovely people. And Marcia had a sister, Rosa, who lives in Malibu now, and a brother, Joe, who lives in Vermont. Pardon?
Rosa now in Malibu.
Yes.
Yeah. And brother what?
Her brother Joe and his wife Betty live in Vermont.
And where did you live when you got married?
When we got married, I have to tell you this incident about you. You asked me about the wedding. And some of these little funny things come back. The rabbi had to meet me before marriage.
What was his name?
He really impressed me. I'm sorry, I don't know.
You're really taxing him.
But anyway, so we had a formal wedding in the temple, Sharon, and I remember standing up beside Marcia and listening to this rabbi drum on and on. And I was kind of looking over what he was reading it upside down to determine where he was in this ceremony. I decided that if he kept on one more minute, I would
read it.
I was going to blitz him a little bit, cut it off, but he finally successfully completed his mission. We had a lot of family there, friends, family from my side, of course a lot of family from Marsha's side. And we honeymooned in New York for, I guess, a week or so, and then we went to Bermuda. And I forget how long we stayed there. Bermuda was just gorgeous at that time of year, late May. And everything was really starting to be in bloom. In case you don't know it, lilies smell only at night. And every day, we stayed in Castle Harbor, every day we retired.